Velkommen til Radio Shalom. Dagens program indeholder to indslag. Joanna Søjer bringer referat fra udstillingen på Luciana, og jeg fortæller om forestillingen Guldkalven, som spiller på Mungo Park. Så velkommen til Radio Shalom. Jeg hedder Abraham Kopenhagen.
Velkommen til en introduktion af en ny udstilling på Louisiana. Jeg hedder Joanna Søjer, og jeg har været med til en præsentation af en ny udstilling om arkitektur. En udstilling i Louisianas serie af udstillinger, der omhandler arkitekturens forbindelser til andre vidensfelter. Dengang handler det om forbindelse til historien, og kalder det for arkitekturens arkeologi. Udstillingen introduceres af museumsdirektøren Paul Erik Tøjner samt af kuratoren Annemette Kallehauge. Derefter kommer der præsentation af de to udstillere. Af den kinesiske Xu Tian Tian, som er grundlægger af tegnestue DNA Design & Architecture, som bor i Beijing. Og hun har studeret ved Harvard Universitet og står ved bygninger ved Songzhuang Art Center og Ordost Art Museum. Derefter kommer der præsentation af Tsuyoshi Tane, som en japansk arkitekt, der har grundlagt tegnestuen Atta i Paris. Og han er uddannet blandt andet på Kunstakademiet på Arkitektskolen i København, og har bygget museer i Estland og i Japan. Han er åben indtil den 17. maj.
Velkommen til pressemødet på gennemgang på Louisiana. På andet kapitel af vores arkitekturserie, Arkitekturens Forbindelser. Det giver Mette ordet om 45 sekunder. Jeg vil bare sige, jeg har sagt det før, jeg siger det igen, at der er to grunde til, at vi interesserer os for arkitektur her på Louisiana og laver arkitekturudstillinger. Den ene er, at vi dagligt døgnet rundt færdes i et stykke arkitektur. Og det betyder noget for den måde, vi tænker over alt, hvad vi laver på. Den formulering, der ligger i det her sted fra nogle arkitekter, som for længst er døde og borte, men det her alligevel sætter sig i vores bevidsthed som noget meget, meget væsentligt og et grundlæggende vilkår for alt det andet, vi laver. Så vi har, synes vi selv, en fornemmelse af, hvad det betyder, at nogen er gået til sag med en vis omhu og med en vis æstetik. Det kan man så forhandle hen ad vejen, om det er godt eller skidt, men altså grundlæggende det at have en meget stor opmærksomhed på rammer og på lokation. Det er sådan den helt grundlæggende driver bag vores engagement i arkitektur. Den anden er kompleksitet. Udstillingens tema, eller udstillingsrækkens tema, hedder jo arkitekturens forbindelser, og det er jo sådan en transdisciplinær eller interdisciplinær dedikation til faget, som vi undersøger. Og det er jo dybest set den samme kompleksitet, som ligger i samtidskunst. Meget ofte. Der findes selvfølgelig samtidskunst, som er meget mere sådan indimensional, men meget af det er den gode samtidskunst roder rundt i vores kollektive erindring og i brokkerne derude for at, måske ikke engang for at skabe orden, men for at gøre opmærksom på, hvor vanskeligt det er at skabe orden, uden at man hele tiden har noget i mente eller taber noget af synet. Og den form for kompleksitet har moderne arkitekter eller nutidsarkitekter også sans for, og vi har sans for deres sans. Så det er det, der går ud på. Det er ikke så meget det byggede miljø, det har vi stor respekt for, men i den her serie går det ud på at sige noget om, hvor kompleks verden er, og få arkitekter til at sige noget om, at selv der, hvor man rejser en bygning, er der et stort, stort fundament af skælvende kompleksitet. Mette,
ja.
Sig noget.
Tak, velkommen. Tak fordi I er kommet alle sammen. Memoryscapes er, som Paul Erik siger, den anden udstilling i den udstillingsserie, vi kalder Arkitekturens Forbindelser, som handler om arkitekturens forbindelser til en mængde andre videnskaber. Og det er rigtig nok, ligesom samtidskunsten, er arkitekturen kompleks og tværfaglig i sit udgangspunkt. Vi har også set en masse arkitektoniske praksiser i de seneste år, som arbejder tværfagligt. Ikke mindst på grund af kravet om et mere klimavenligt byggeri, som i sig selv kræver, at flere fagligheder går sammen om at tænke arkitekturen. Men i sit udgangspunkt er arkitekturen tværfaglig, både fordi at den er et æstetisk udsagn, men jo også altid har en funktionalitet. Det handler om i den her udstillingsserie om, at arkitekturen aldrig står alene. I den første udstilling i serien inviterede vi nogle arkitekter til at vise deres arbejde med biologer, med biologi og biologisk forskning. Og det handlede mere om at gå ned i en meget lille skala og på en måde skabe et nyt arkitektonisk sprog. Der var vi helt nede og kigge på naturens processer, på biologiens processer. Og det er jo selvfølgelig en udstilling, som så havde en meget mindre skala, også i sit output, altså det vi så i udstillingen. Den her gang, der kigger vi på arkitekter, der arbejder med forbindelsen til kulturgeografi. De kulturgeografiske videnskaber som antropologi, arkeologi, geografi, en række videnskaber, som handler om at kigge på stedet, som handler om at kortlægge, definere, beskrive et særligt sted, som jo i virkeligheden også er et af arkitekturens fornemmeste metoder. Og det handler om, at de her videnskaber, som de her arkitekter har forbindelser til, der er feltarbejdet den vigtigste metode. Det vil sige, det er processen, der hvor man kommer til et sted, hvor man rejser til et sted og begynder at beskrive det. Vi har inviteret de her to arkitekter til at vise deres feltarbejde. Så det vi ser i udstillingen, det er forarbejdet til arkitekturen. Vi kommer også til at se noget arkitektur, fordi metoden fletter sig sammen med værket. Men det er forarbejdet fortrinsvist. Vi har inviteret to arkitekter, der bruger rejsen eller bevægelsen som et redskab. Man kan lave feltarbejde på forskellige måder, som antropologen, der rejser til et givet sted, taler med folk, bevæger sig og erfarer stedet gennem bevægelse og ved at tale med folk. Så kan man foretage en rejse, som er mere virtuel, hvor man rejser i historisk materiale, i historiske referencer, i billeder, notationer, det skrevne og det mundtlige ord, der knytter sig til et sted. Her der er alle de her forbindelser mellem alle disse historiske referencer, det der skaber et landskab, der på en måde lægger sig til det fysiske sted. Det er to forskellige arkitekter og to forskellige måder at drive feltarbejde på, som vi skal se i udstillingen. Den første arkitekt, vi har inviteret, er den japanske arkitekt Toyoshi Tane, som er bosat i Paris. Vi ser, hvordan han arbejder med stedet gennem historisk research i form af billeder. Billeder, der danner ord, som igen avler billeder, hvor den her historiefortælling bliver afgørende for, hvordan bygningens form og program ser ud. Vi ser disse billedsamlinger i udstillingen, som ikke bare er arkitektens egen opslagstavle, men også tegnestuens fælles sprog og den måde, man kommunikerer til klienter og bygherrer på. Samtidig ser vi Toyoshi Tanes redskab, som er modellen, det ser vi også i udstillingen, som er modeller, der først er tilvirket ud fra det forhåndenværende sømsprincip, det vil sige, at man bruger det, man har for hånden, et stykke resttræ fra værkstedet, et stykke ståluld, eller en hvilken som helst andet artefakt. Her begynder formstudierne at blande sig med fund fra stedet, fordi Toyoshi rejser også til stedet og samler på de ting, han finder på stedet. Det kan være gamle mursten, facadepaneler måske. Og på den måde ser vi udviklingen mellem det todimensionelle billede og den tredimensionelle model. Vi ser samtidig Ternes samling af objekter, der på forskellige måder fungerer som inspiration for hans projekter. Det kan være rester af materiale fra et forhenværende byggeri, eller et objekt, han har købt i relation til sit feltarbejde. Det kan være mange tusind år gamle vaser eller en simpel sten. Objektets historie og hans eget forhold til objektet påvirker projektet. Det handler om at aktivere historien og fortiden som en del af løsningen på fremtidens arkitektur. Tane kalder sin tilgang for arkitektonisk arkeologi, og det er en udgravning af erindringsmateriale med henblik på at gøre arkitekturen meningsfuld og robust i den verden, vi lever i. Den anden arkitekt, det er den kinesiske arkitekt Su Changjiang, der arbejder med to forskellige greb, som vi viser i udstillingen. Det er arkitektonisk akupunktur og det, hun kalder productionscape. Og i udstillingen ser vi også Chang Changs feltarbejde på øen Meshu Island, som bliver fortalt gennem en række film, en dokumentarisk film, som er bygget op om en meget stor bambustruktur, som vi har bygget nede i udstillingen. Og feltarbejdet er det, der fører til hendes ene arbejdsmetode, nemlig det, der hedder arkitektonisk akupunktur, som er inspireret af den kinesiske behandlingsform akupunktur, hvor man jo har en meget lille nål, som man stikker ind et sted i kroppen, og som så har en stor gavnlig effekt. Det betyder, det her arkitektonisk akupunktur, er jo, at man laver et meget, meget lille arkitektonisk indgreb, men som har den størst mulige effekt. Hun gør brug af arkitektonisk akupunktur både på Meshu Island, hvor hun bliver bedt om at bygge et museum, som skal vise historien om et meget gammelt tempel, der findes på øen. Men i stedet for at lave endnu et monument, så vælger hun at lave 6 små nålestik, altså 6 små arkitektoniske indgreb i stedet for, som får publikum eller turisterne rundt på øen og ser, hvordan folk faktisk lever på øen, i stedet for at gense templet i en ny form. Og der handler det om at se det hverdagsliv, som findes på øen, og få aktiveret den almindelige hverdag som en del af en oplevelse. Så vi viser modeller og i forskellige skalaforhold. Nogle er 1:1, nogle er mindre traditionelle arkitekturmodeller af projektet Meshu Island, men også et andet projekt, hvor hun arbejder med arkitektonisk akupunktur, som er arbejdet med det, der hedder Tolo-bygninger, som er en meget gammel bygningsform, som lige nu altså findes mange steder i Kina, men er forladte og ruineret. UNESCO har renoveret et par stykker af dem, men det som Su Changjiang gør, det er, at hun har taget ud til de forskellige Tolo'er i et område, hun allerede kender, og har valgt dem ud og startet et samarbejde med den kommune om at renovere de her Tolo-bygninger. Men det bliver igen gjort med en meget lille nålestik. Så det vil sige, at det er ikke en total renovering. Det er ikke en klassisk renovering, hvor man fører byggeriet tilbage til dets oprindelige form. Man lader ruinen stå som en slags arkitektonisk typologi med en kvalitet i sig selv. Så halvdelen af byggeriet er måske stadigvæk en ruin, og en lille bitte del er blevet renoveret og kommer de mennesker, der bor rundt omkring de her Tolo-bygninger til gode. Det andet... Den anden metode, som Su Changjiang arbejder med, som vi også viser i udstillingen, er det, hun kalder productionscape. Og det er på sin vis også afledt af det feltarbejde, hun laver. At hun er ude og tale med mennesker på de steder, hun skal bygge, og samtidig selv opsøger stederne uden at have fået opgaven, men selv tager ud og ser, hvad foregår der i de her områder. Det handler om, at det landlige Kina lider under en stor urbanisering, altså at folk flytter derfra, men når der stadigvæk er mennesker, der arbejder med nogle traditionelle erhverv ude på landet, som Su Changjiang gerne vil støtte og gøre, at de kan blive ved med at leve på den måde, de gør, og med den produktion, de lever af. det kunne være tofufabrikker eller fabrikker, der producerer brun sukker eller te. Hun er i gang med et projekt, som hun kalder Mushroom Community Center, som er et productionskab. Og et productionskab, det er en blanding mellem en fabrik og et landskab, et produktionslandskab. Det er en fabrik, som samtidig er et slags besøgscenter, som hun kombinerer to arkitektoniske typologier, hvor publikum kan følge produktionen, samtidig med, at produktionen foregår. Så man bevæger sig gennem et arkitektonisk landskab, der understøtter den produktion, der foregår. Og på den måde så opgraderer hun både den produktion, der findes i de her landområder. Hun gør, at de kan møde de moderne standarder for fødevareproduktion. Men hun inviterer også de turister, der allerede kommer til området, ind for at se. Så det bliver sådan en kombination, som gavner både de mennesker, der bor ved stedet, men også de mennesker, der kommer for at besøge det. Vi har bygget et productionskab i udstillingen, som er en lille del af hans Mushroom Community Center, hvor vi dyrker, kultiverer svampe og høster dem, og det vil være en produktion, der pågår over hele udstillingens forløb. Svampene bliver solgt og spist af mennesker, så de indgår i en cyklus, og er på den måde en en-til-en gengivelse af hendes idé om productionskab, som hun også kalder levende museer. Det, der er vigtigt at forstå her, er også med det arkitektoniske akupunktur, at det, som Chang Chang selv siger, at man kan finde 1000 grunde til at bygge, men en bygning igen er ikke altid nødvendig for at skabe arkitektur. Se, om jeg har fået det hele med. Memoryscapes handler altså om det arbejde, der ligger før arkitekturen, men som på en måde også er arkitekturen qua nærheden mellem feltarbejde og den arkitektoniske løsning. Det handler om forbindelsen til fortiden, erindringer og fortællinger, og om hvordan udgravning af disse narrativer skaber nye måder at se fremtidens arkitektur på. Det var det, jeg havde at sige. Vi kan få arkitekterne med ned og fortælle om deres udstillinger om et øjeblik. Swift into English. I have introduced the exhibition. The architects Toyoshi Tana and Su Changchang is here present, and they will give you a short introduction to the exhibitions in the exhibition. So shortly we will go there, and we'll start with Toyoshi Tana, which is in the first gallery. We have like 20 minutes, and then we head to the big gallery where Su Changchang will introduce. And I will ask you to wait with the questions to as both architects have presented, and then you're welcome to ask them any questions afterwards. Thank you. Yeah.
By Toyoshi through your very beautiful exhibition upstairs. And I definitely share the cultural resonance. You know, I feel I was also thinking about it at the same time when you were talking about your project. I was also thinking about just like a reflection for myself to think about how we started to practice, especially engaging in the rural context, and it's always about culture, history, tradition. So in this sense, let's start from this productionscape, which is a theme, a subject that we feel like getting very intrigued and also inspired by how people make the productions with the place they live by utilizing the natural resource. And which is really based on specific ecological conditions, the ecosystem. So it all starts from the ecosystem, the nature. For example, the first generation of the village will arrive to the place, whether it's a mountain location, or it's a continent, flatland, or it's an island, coastal area, by identifying the potential production out of the local available resources to make a living, make a survival, and then the family settles down there, you know, live, you know, through generations with a certain type of production passing through generations, which also become not only the way to generate income, but also cultivating the tradition, festivities, celebrations of life. So that is the culture. So, but to make it short, culture evolves from ecology. And this production isn't just the producing, but really how the celebration of life is formulated through this production. It always engage with the collective laboring. So people are working together. So this is a collective scene. I mean, the production itself, whether it's cultivating mushroom or making tofu, cooking brown sugar, these are all the collective scenes of how people work together, how people share, and also how people distribute the products, and also how the culture, how the different type of festivals based on every type, specific type of production, because it all come with probably different seasons, different time of the year. So that's really, we think this is the concept, not only for the, you know, social or economic purpose, but also in the long term, a cultural aspect and how we can engage in architectural thinking. And more importantly, how the production scape can adapt to the climate change, because that's the probably the climate change brings the most impact to people who are living really relying on the weather, right? How you make your income out of the nature. So I wanted to start with this room, that is after discussion with the curators, that we ask if we can have the cultivation of mushroom. So I guess this is probably the first time ever for Louisiana Museum to have the live production, no? Within the museum. So, I think this is also the concept that, you know, along with this cultural exhibition, it's also engaged in a kind of a economic or the social process that I found it also very intriguing that I was able to meet this young man who's taking care, looking after all these mushroom, very young people, which is very rare from where I come from. In China, we only have elder villagers who are interested in who are still working in agriculture, but the young people are all in cities, you know. The most popular program to study in colleges would be computer science now these days. So I feel that there's something that we are also, you know, and kind of a new message or a new type of, not just the production, you know, the different types of mushroom, but also new type of social movement with that, or message that we're also receiving come along with this exhibition. So I think this is definitely a starting point to say that it's not just we exhibiting here, but it's really the collective collaboration, exchange, sharing of thinkings, architectural thinking, social thinkings, that, you know, start with this, that really make this exhibition happening. And it's also a process for us, always working in a remote area in China, in the mountain villages, on the isolated islands, but also, you know, to bring our work to share with everyone in Copenhagen in Denmark. And I feel like, and also with the Tsuyoshi Sam's exhibition and architectural cultural thinking, I think we can definitely bring a discussion all together to find a common ground. So for the architectural side, I will make it short that you will already see the production itself, you know, happening in each different villages. That's already an architectural phenomenon. When you're within this space, I mean, this is quite a different type of, you know, humidity and light happening in the cultivation space, and see the mushroom growing. Actually, I was told that the mushroom can grow really fast, and look at all the mushrooms up there. So that's already a phenomenon, and that spontaneous for us, we just identify as kind of the probably the soul of architecture, how we work with the production scape. And that's generating with collective working as collective memory of the community, as well as the cultural identity. So then we can move to the next chapter. Here you come to a different part of the mountain region in China, which is my home province, in it's called Fujian province. And in southwest of Fujian, Tulou is very particular vernacular typology in this region that was with a history of about almost 1,000 years that really started the things troubled time in the history. This is very difficult, troublesome region with lots of wars and battles, and in the mountain, and also people needed to fight against maybe the wild animals as well. So around almost like 1,000 years ago, the local this Tulou typology was started in this region. As a, first of all, as a defense structure. So people were living together. So you see the Tulou, this typology with the exterior wall, it's a very thick protective ram earth wall, very often with small windows and sometimes almost no windows and only one entry and one exit to this large structure, which is also for collective living that can accommodate up to hundreds of the people living together. And every family will have a row house with the kitchen on the ground floor, storage second floor, and bedrooms upstairs, maximum to 5 levels. So each row house is owned by one family, but you will need to go through, you know, the common stairs, sometimes, usually 4 stairs. So for the bigger Tulou, maybe 6 stairs. So that means that if you need to go to your bedroom from the ground floor, from your kitchen, you need to pass through the corridor to neighbors' bedrooms first. So that means that this is a very closely bonded community, very strong community, because of the extreme condition that people needed to live together, to fight together, not only to work together, but also to fight together against any type of invasions or wars, battles in this in the difficult times. And so this is maybe more extreme collective, but, you know, in order to survive. To fight against common enemies. So the structure is very particular, you know, as with the coming along with this defense purpose, people can close down, you know, close off this entire Tulou, which has only 2 access to the outside, right? So then you can close down the whole structure and live in a much more protected way for up to 6 months. Because the structure, you know, with the people living together, and, you know, also the storage, the whole entire second floor is for storage of food, of whatever you need to stock up during the battle time. And also the open field in the center is also for production, agricultural production, or however you need to prepare. So, and it's also as a common space during the more peaceful, easier time. So this is a very specific, rich culture, also formulated based on this particular type of vernacular structure system, really out of very specific social background. So we wanted to bring this and also to join, you know, the cultural dialogue here. That but more importantly, this is also a social architectural urgency that we saw the Tulo. We visited the Tulo region in year 2020. Most of the Chinese people would know about Tulo as World Cultural Heritage, inscribed by UNESCO, right? So that's quite a national pride. But then, if you come to the region, you would only see that only 46 Tulo buildings are inscribed. But this is very common typology that there are still thousands of Tulo buildings without this higher rank of heritage building that doesn't have the sufficient maintenance funding, and was really because of the economic development in come along with the urbanization process in China in past 3 decades, 40 years, and a lot of families have already moved out of the Tulo buildings and building up their own single family houses. So that has been quite a common situation, that thousands of Tulo buildings become vacant, abandoned. So that's that we brought up this again acupunctural strategy to take the all these relic Tulo buildings and to bring it into a social design strategy or more systematic collaboration with the local government communities as well to revive these Tulo buildings. So that is to say that these ancient traditional vernacular typology can still become performative in our contemporary context and transform into community center, public cultural programs when the original functionalities are not valid anymore. You know, now these days you don't need a Tulo to defend enemies. You rather like to open it up as a welcoming or landing area for visitors, but also a community center that still possesses collective memories.
I know we should wait with questions, but since we're here, can you tell us, is this a model that is depicting a proposal, or is that something that you found? Is this an existing building that you found?
So this is, I mean, all the Tulo buildings are existing buildings. We're not building new Tulo, it's not necessary. And this is actually that Tulo building, Suimei Tulo, which still has a few number of original inhabitants, residents living here, but the rest of most of the Tulo, I think it may be by the photo, you can see the first Tulo here. This is the first photo that you see that there were people living here, but most of the Tulo space has been vacant. Vacant as a void. It doesn't have this unit, the whole unit is empty, and the corridors are disconnected. So the circulation was really, I mean, the system really didn't work. So we took this as a starting point to complete the corridors, but not necessarily to repair all the units. That is to leave them open. On one side is safe, the funding, right? You don't have to rebuild everything because they don't need it anymore. They don't need units. People don't want to, like a lot of younger people don't want to live in these units anymore. But then these voids, then, you know, we don't need like a huge massive budget for the revival process, but then we can keep these voids open and potentially can become the new community space or a platform for like new business startups. So these are the ideas that to take the ruling or the void, the ruling as a new typology, as a new opportunity for the local community to bring in maybe more entrepreneur proposals. That is how you can look at the existing available spaces after the space is not needed for living anymore, but then can still be transformed into social, into public, into economic spaces, you know, to potentially can also generate income for the local people. So we consider this is also a production scape in a way, you know, to in the contemporary context, and how the space can be transformed for, you know, welcome to the visitors as open spaces, but also potentially can bring the new economic kind of an influence or potentials. So now we go to the island.
We have time?
Yeah.
We have time. Okay. So let's just go around. Yeah, exactly. Our productionscape as well as memoryscape. And this is a small island, it's called Meizhong Island. It's a small island in my home city, Putian City, that I always visited this island during my childhood, mostly in the summer times. This is an island actually, it's the home island of Mazu, the goddess of sea, who is worshipped by the global Chinese society. And almost everywhere in the world, if there's a Chinese community, there's a worship, or there is one temple to as a Mazu temple. And the city of Macau, the name of Macau comes from Mazu temple. It's the sound, it's a local pronunciation of Mazu temple. So, and the Mazu temple, this system as a global system, culture and custom belief system, is also applying for the World Culture Heritage at this moment. So it's quite a very influential culture, but coming from this island. And Mazu is a real person who was born actually over 1,060 years ago, a real person who sacrificed her life, probably I think was at age 28, to save the villagers. So she has been really admired and respect as, you know, to become the goddess of sea, starting from the region and then expanded, you know, to the global recognition. So this has been the story, the background of this Meizhong Island, and by the temple at the north part of the island, which is quite magnificent image, you know, cluster of buildings along the topography, has become the very popular pilgrimage destination for global Chinese society. Every year there will be over 3 million pilgrimage visitors come to the island, and mostly could to come to arrive at the temple for the celebration for the pilgrimage. And every year, almost you would encounter a certain group of people coming for the pilgrimage almost every day on island. So there's a really significant
presence of culture, of this belief, custom on the island. Besides that, this is also quite dense urban fabric with 40,000 population, 11 villages, which has a few elementary school and one middle school. So this is still quite active, vibrant community, mostly by fishermen villages, communities on this island. So with the invitation to initial invitation is to work on the a iconic museum like the Bilbao. I think it was really the global kind of influence of this Bilbao effect now also reached to our island, mm-hmm. that the local administration was proposing that we should build a kind of iconic landmark building to attract visitors, especially to bring the pilgrimage visitors, over 3 million of visitors, to be able to visit the other part of the island. But after the research, we made a different proposal. You know, for this small island, you can drive around within half an hour. It's not big. And this island itself is a living museum. It's also the living memory of how people live on such a harsh environment without any, natural resources like the continent, and how people can make their life, happening, passing through generations on such a harsh environment with their very specific local indigenous knowledges and skill sets and wisdoms. So this is already an island carrying with the life memories. So we don't really need a centralized museum, landmark museum, but rather we can break, the potential building form into a cluster of locations that going around the island, to understand. With such a small island, the west bank, which is the mudland facing the continent, the east bank, at the east side of the island, is looking out to the ocean where water drops dramatically, 10 meters, just right out of the island. So it's already very different kind of ecosystem. And fishermen were able to cultivate different type of production on both on both sides. On one side is the mushland, it's the mudland. So come along with this small oyster cultivation, and now mangrove plantation. And on the other side is rather the fish ponds in the ocean water. So you see that there's already such a difference and ecological, cultural production information already on existing on this island. So as an architect, how do you translate this information, this knowledge, these messages into architectural expression? So that has become a challenge for us, instead of stocking every information into one building, can we just open up to the nature? Or maybe the architecture was already existing within the space already formulated by the nature with the different geographical condition, with the mudland, with high tide and with the low tides. There's a different type of species, vegetation already growing in different sides of the island, and how the fishermen living, the community living on the island since over 1,000 years ago, have already navigated this the different patterns of the local available resources, and also on top of that, they were able to invent different type of cultivation. For example, the seaweed plantation on the mudland, and also the incubator for the seaweed seeds, we call that baby seaweed, to incubate it within the structure, in the space for like 8 to 10 months in a year before they were transported to the cultivation on the mudland. So all of these were enormous and very beautiful knowledge that we I mean, especially for myself coming from this city, this region, was also my first time to understand that this local wisdom, knowledge, how people can make such a production in a smart way, in the you know, in the dialogue with the local climate, with this harsh, ocean climate, and by navigating, you know, the pattern, the rhythm of the nature of the ocean. So I don't want to get into the details of the project, but the idea is that, you know, that was come along with all the process of working on the island. It really transformed how we understand, you know, what is architecture? Does it have to be a completely artificial new object, or architecture was already existing? We just need to reveal that, you know, the design was already existing in the context. And what is the role of architects? Maybe this is also a reflection on ourselves, on our profession. How do we deal with you know, such a powerful landscape and large scale of space already existing there? How can architects engage in the context with the community, into the environment, into the eco conditions, you know, without creating this landmark buildings everywhere? How can we translate the local legacy into its own landmark? So I say, I hope that this will probably carry on to the further discussion.
To ask you through your very beautiful exhibition upstairs, and I definitely share the cultural resonance. You know, I feel I was also thinking about it at the same time when you were talking about your project. I was also thinking about just like a reflection for myself to think about how we started to practice, especially engaging in the rural context, and it's always about culture, history, tradition. So in this sense, that starts from this production scape, which is a theme, a subject that we feel like getting very intrigued and also inspired by how people make the productions with their, the place they live, by utilizing a natural resource. And which is really based on specific ecological conditions, the ecosystem. So it all starts from the ecosystem, the nature. For example, the first generation of the village will arrive to the place, whether it's a mountain location, or it's a continent, flatland, or it's an island, coastal area, by identifying the potential production out of the local available resources to make a living, make a survival, and then the family settles down there, you know, live, you know, through generations with a certain type of production passing through generations, which also become not only the way to generate income, but also cultivating the tradition, festivities, celebrations of life. So that is the culture. So, but to make it short, culture evolves from ecology. And this production isn't just the producing, but really how the celebration of life is formulated through this production. It always engages with the collective laboring. So people are working together. So this is a collective scene. I mean, the production itself, whether it's cultivating mushroom or making tofu, cooking brown sugar, these are all the collective scenes of how people work together, how people share, and also how people distribute the products. And also how the culture, how the different type of festivals based on every type, specific type of production, because it all come with probably different seasons, different time of the year. So that's really, we think this is the concept, not only for the social or economic purpose, but also in the long term, a cultural aspect and how we can engage in architectural thinking, and more importantly, how the production scape can adapt to the climate change. Because probably the climate change brings the most impact to people who are living really relying on the weather, right? How you make your income out of the nature. So I wanted to start with this room, that is after discussion with the curators, that we asked if we can have the cultivation of mushroom. So I guess this is probably the first time I went for Louisiana Museum to have a live production, no? Within a museum. So I think this is also the concept that, along with this cultural exhibition, it's also engaged in economic or the social process that I found it also very intriguing that I was able to meet this young man who's taking care, looking after all these mushrooms. Very young people, which is very rare from where I come from. In China, we only have elder villagers who are interested in who are still working in agriculture, but the young people are all in cities, the most popular program to study in colleges would be computer science now these days. So I feel that there's something that we are also, and kind of a new message or a new type of a not just the production, the different types of mushroom, but also new type of social movement with that or message that we're also receiving come along with this exhibition. So I think this is definitely a starting point to say that it's not just we're exhibiting here, but it's really the collective collaboration, exchange, sharing, of thinkings, architectural thinking, social thinkings, that start with this, that really make this exhibition happening. And it's also a process for us, always working in a remote area in China, in the mountain villages, on the isolated islands, but also to bring our work to share with everyone in Copenhagen and in Denmark. And I feel like, and also with the Tsuyoshi Sam's exhibition and architectural cultural thinking, I think we can definitely bring a discussion all together to find a common ground. So for the architectural side, I will make it short that you will already see the production itself, happening in each different villages. That's already an architectural phenomenon when you're within this space. I mean, this is quite a different type of, humidity and light happening in the cultivation space, and see the mushroom growing. Actually, I was told that the mushroom can grow really fast. I mean, look at all the mushrooms up there. So that's already a phenomenon. And that spontaneous for us, we just identify as kind of probably the soul of architecture, how we work with the production scape. And that's generating with collective working as collective memory of the community, as well as the cultural identity. So then we can move to the next chapter. Come to a different part of the mountain region in China, which is my home province. It's called Fujian province, and in southwest of Fujian, Tulou is very particular vernacular typology in this region that was with a history of about almost 1,000 years that really started the things troubled time in the history. This is very difficult, troublesome region with lots of wars and battles, and in the mountain, and also people needed to fight against maybe the wild animals as well. So around almost like 1,000 years ago, the local this Tulo typology was started in this region as a, first of all, as a defense structure. So people were living together. So you see the Tulo, this typology with the exterior wall as a very thick protective ram earth wall, very often with small windows and sometimes almost no windows and only one entry and one exit to this large structure, which is also for collective living that can accommodate up to hundreds of the people living together. And every family will have a row house with the kitchen on the ground floor, storage second floor, and bedrooms upstairs, maximum to 5 levels. So each row house is owned by one family, but you will need to go through, you know, the common stairs, sometimes, usually 4 stairs. So for the bigger Tulo, maybe 6 stairs. So that means that if you need to go to your bedroom from the ground floor, from your kitchen, you need to pass through the corridor to neighbors' bedrooms first. So that means that this is a very closely bonded community, very strong community, because of the extreme condition that people needed to live together, to fight together, not only to work together, but also to fight together against any type of invasions or wars, battles in this in the difficult times. And so this is maybe more extreme collective, but, you know, in order to survive, to fight against common enemies. So the structure is very particular, you know, as with the coming along with this defense purpose, people can close down, you know, close off this entire Tulo, which has only 2 access to the outside, right? So then you can close down the whole structure and live in a much more protected way for up to 6 months. Because the structure, you know, with the people living together and, you know, also the storage, the whole entire second floor is for storage of food, of whatever you need to stock up during the battle time. And also the open field in the center is also for production, agricultural production, or however you need to prepare. So, and it's also as a common space during the more peaceful, easier time. So this is a very specific rich culture, also formulated based on this particular type of vernacular structure system, really out of very specific social background. So we wanted to bring this and also to join, you know, the cultural dialogue here that, but more importantly, this is also a social architectural urgency that we saw the Tulo, we visited the Tulo region in year 2020. Most of the Chinese people would know about Tulo as World Cultural Heritage, inscribed by UNESCO, right? So that's quite a national pride. But then if you come to the region, you would only see that only 46 Tulo buildings are inscribed. But this is very common typology that there are still thousands of Tulo buildings without this higher rank of heritage building that doesn't have the sufficient maintenance funding, and was really and because of the economic development in come along with the urbanization process in China in past 3 decades, up 40 years, and a lot of families have already moved out of the Tulo buildings and building up their own single family houses. So that has been a quite a common situation, that thousands of Tulo buildings become vacant, abandoned. So that's that we brought up this again acupunctural strategy to take the all these relic Tulo buildings and to bring it into a social design strategy or more systematic collaboration with the local government communities as well to revive these Tulo buildings. So that is to say that these ancient traditional vernacular typology can still become performative in our contemporary context and transform into community center, public cultural programs when the original functionalities are not valid anymore. You know, now these days you don't need a Tulo to defend enemies. We would rather like to open it up as a welcoming or landing area for visitors, but also a community center that still possesses the collective memories.
I know we should wait with questions, but since we're here, can you tell us, is this a model that is
it's
depicting a proposal
half.
Or is that something that you found? Is this an existing building that you found?
So this is, I mean, all the Tulo buildings are existing buildings. We're not building new Tulo, it's not necessary. And this is actually that Tulo building, Sui Mei Tulo, which still has a few number of original inhabitants, residents living here. But the rest of most of the Tulo, I think it may be by the photo, you can see the that original, yes, that the first Tulo here. This is the first photo that you see that there were people living here, but most of the Tulo space has been vacant, vacant as a void. It doesn't have this unit, like the whole unit is empty, and the corridors are disconnected. So the circulation was really, I mean, the system really didn't work. So we took this as a starting point to complete the corridors, but not necessarily to repair all the units. Mm. That is to leave them open. On one side is save the funding, right? You don't have to rebuild everything because they don't need it anymore. They don't need the units. People don't want to, like a lot of younger people don't want to live in these units anymore. But then these voids, then, you know, we don't need like a huge massive budget for the revival process, but then we can keep these voids open and potentially can become the new community space or a platform for like new business startups. So these are the ideas that to take the ruin or the voids, the ruin as a new typology, as a new opportunity for the local community to bring in maybe more entrepreneur proposals. That is how you can look at the existing available spaces after the space is not needed for a living anymore, but then can still be transformed into social, into public, into economic spaces, you know, to potentially can also generate income for the local people. So we consider this is also a production scape in a way, you know, to in the contemporary context and how the space can be transformed for, you know, welcome to the visitors as open spaces, but also potentially can bring the new economic kind of a influence or potentials. So now we go to the island.
Yeah.
We have to?
Yeah.
We
have to. Okay.
So let's just go around. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
now we arrived at the third chapter of our production scape, as well as memory scape. And this is a small island, it's called Meizhong Island. It's a small island in my home city, Putian City, that I always visited this island during my childhood, mostly in the summer times. This is an island, actually, it's the home island of Ma Zu, the goddess of sea, who is worshipped by the global Chinese society. And almost everywhere in the world, if there's a Chinese community, there's a worship, or there's at least one temple to as a Ma Zu temple. And the city of Macau, the name of Macau comes from Ma Zu temple. It's the sound, it's a local pronunciation of Ma Zu temple. So, and the Ma Zu temple, this system as a global system, culture and custom belief system, is also applying for the world culture heritage at this moment. So it's quite a very influential culture, but coming from this island. And Ma Zu is a real person who was born actually over 1,060 years ago, a real person who sacrificed her life, probably I think was at age 28, to save the villagers. So she has been really admired and respected as, you know, to become the goddess of sea, starting from the region and then expanded, you know, to the global recognition. And in so this has been the story, the background of this Meizhong Island, and the temple at the north part of the island, which is quite magnificent image, you know, cluster of buildings along the topography, has become the very popular pilgrimage destination for global Chinese society. Every year there will be over 3 million pilgrimage visitors come to the island, and mostly only to come to arrive at the temple for the celebration, for the pilgrimage. And every year, almost, you would encounter a certain group of people coming for the pilgrimage almost every day on island. So there's a really significant presence of culture, of this belief, custom on the island. Besides that, this is also quite dense urban fabric with 40,000 population, 11 villages, which has a few elementary school and one middle school. So this is still quite active, vibrant community, mostly you know, by fishermen villages, communities on this island. So with the invitation to initial invitation is to work on the a iconic museum like the Bilbao. I think it was really the global kind of influence of this Bilbao effect now also reached to our island, mm-hmm. that the local administration was proposing that we should build a kind of iconic landmark building to attract visitors, especially to bring the pilgrimage visitors, over 3 million of visitors, to be able to visit the other part of the island. But after the research, we made a different proposal. You know, for this small island, you can drive around within half an hour. It's not big. And this island itself is a living museum. It's also the living memory of how people lived on such a harsh environment without any, natural resources like the continent, and how people can make their life, you know, happening, passing through generations on such a harsh environment with their very specific local indigenous knowledges and skill sets and wisdoms. So this is already an island carrying with the life memories. So we don't really need a centralized museum, landmark museum, but rather we can break, you know, the potential building form into a cluster of locations that going around the island, you know, to really to understand with a, such a small island, the West Bank, which is the mudland facing the continent, the east bank, at the east side of the island, is looking out to the ocean where water drops dramatically, 10 meters, you know, just right out of the island. So it's already very different kind of ecosystem. And fishermen were able to cultivate different type of production on both on both sides. On one side is the mushroom, it's the mudland, so come along with this small oyster cultivation, and now mangrove plantation. And on the other side is rather the fish ponds, the in the ocean water. So you see that there's already such a difference and ecological, cultural production information already on existing on this island. So as an architect, how do you translate this information, this knowledge, these messages into architectural expression? So that has become a challenge for us, you know, instead of stocking every information into one building, can we just open up to the nature? Or maybe the architecture was already existing within the space already formulated by the nature, with the different geographical condition, with the mudland, with high tide, with the low tides. And so there's a different type of species, vegetation already growing in different sides of the island, and how the fishermen living, the community living on the island since over 1,000 years ago, have already navigated this, the different patterns of the local available resources, and also on top of that, they were able to invent, you know, different type of cultivation. For example, the seaweed plantation on the mudland, and also the incubator for the seaweed seeds. We call that baby seaweed, you know, to incubate it within the structure in the space for like 8 to 10 months in a year, before they were transported to the cultivation on the mudland. So all of these were enormous and very beautiful knowledge that we, I mean, especially for myself coming from this city, this region, was also my first time to understand that this local wisdom, knowledge, how people can make such a production in a smart way, in the you know, in the dialogue with the local climate, with this harsh ocean climate, and by navigating, you know, the pattern, the rhythm of the nature of the ocean. So I don't want to get into the details of the project, but the idea is that, you know, that come along with all the process of working on the island. It really transformed how we understand, you know, what is architecture? Does it have to be a completely artificial new object, or architecture was already existing? We just need to reveal that, you know, the design was already existing in the context. And what is the role of architects? Maybe this is also a reflection on ourselves, on our profession. How do we deal with you know, such a powerful landscape and large scale of space already existing there? How can architects engage in the context with the community, into the environment, into the eco conditions, you know, without creating this landmark buildings everywhere? How can we translate the local legacy into its own landmark? So I hope that this will probably carry on to the further discussion. Thank you so much.
part has kind of own project where this is a section of Imperial Hotel where the introduction text has been just written. There are sketch models has been made by our hands. And then there are sometimes these kind of keywords of this kind of important research, that is how Tokyo has been modernized after upon our my life that I go in Tokyo to really understand how the Tokyo has been built as the environment. On the other side, also this is the project part after sketch and research, and then to be testing to have different volumetries, how to fit all the programs, and towards the structure, and then goes to the sort of latest model that is exhibited there. So in this sort of steps of making the model back to the research, and then again making a model and back to the research. So this kind of back and forth, to really try to back into the research to understand where we are, and then giving this kind of journey of going towards to the project, but always trying to go backwards to really think for, again, takes time to understand the both archaeological way and also the life of our anthropological way to see how architecture can be built upon our contemporary society. Especially Imperial Hotel was, as you may know, the Frank Lloyd Wright, which made second generation of Imperial Hotel, which was one of the important buildings in Tokyo. And unfortunately needs to be turned down in 1968. And then now currently their third generation has been built. And then there was a competition in 2019 that we were invited to propose the building for fourth generation. And after the competition that we won it, then they told us it's going to be completed 2036. That I made myself that, okay, how am I going to be the age of 2036? Because the challenge for being good in health. But also that moment makes me to think that this is going to be just open 2036, then stay longer. So the how the future will be, to force myself to think for our future, not only now or today, but more to think really 22nd century of how we won't be here mostly, but how people live in 22nd century, how architects project to think further the timeline of continuity of the way that we can really also posting for people to be happy living in our society. This is a mission for architect always. We are trying to think for the future, but also not only now and us, but it's important to see the generation to generation that we are also able to heritage and then keep this importance of continuity of how it's been built from the past and how we can build in today and how we can give to the future. So that's how generally all the approach of designing the architecture of today from our side is very important to think for this continuity of the work.
Your question. Yeah. I come from a local radio. My name is Joanna Soya, and I'm representing a Jewish radio in local Jewish radio in Copenhagen area. I would like to ask you, you have mentioned that you are educated in the Royal Art Academy. How do you combine the influence of Danish architectural tradition with the Japanese? I mean, they seem related in terms of minimalism, and I can see it in your way of thinking and structures, but how do you understand this?
For example, like I born in Japan, and especially in Tokyo, which is something to realize after overall of my life, that actually is a very unique city, of very complex,
yes,
and very automated of our human system. So to come to Scandinavia, first time was Sweden, and after coming to Denmark, this Scandinavian way of life, of the understanding of society and all this kind of community of how to build the quality of life, are very much important to have society as much as design and as much as the architecture, and now it's food. Quality has been very much sort of giving comfort, a way of life. To connect with the some tradition of this kind of way to build the society. There are some similarities for understanding the material of nature that you can be surrounded by the, for example, bricks that are very important tradition of Danish architecture, and then Japanese woods to be able to understand materials really available around your environment. But still, this kind of craftsmanship, which is very high, I have to say, more to realize in Denmark, that are very high quality of even skills, and the challenge for the craftsmanship to build the building was so important of the quality of the longevity of life of the Danish architecture. The contemporary architecture, we are learning a lot from this kind of Scandinavian way of making design, done very fast and very challenging for not the form, but I think the Scandinavian, especially Denmark, I used to live in Denmark to really learn from this kind of Danish quality that becomes, I think, more internationally inspirational. So, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Radio Shalom var inviteret til verdenspremiere på forestillingen Guldkalven på Mungo Park Teatret i Allerød. Forestillingen handler om Novo Nordisk 100 års historie, som involverer millioner af mennesker, ansatte, patienter og ikke mindst investorerne. August og Marie Krog, som var forskere og levede i en tid, da sukkersygen var lige ved dødsdom. Og det har haft stor indflydelse på deres forhold, da Marie blev syg. Det var kampen om ikke at miste den, man elsker. Det var kampen om overlevelse. Også Novo Nordisk kæmper om sin overlevelse i et marked med konkurrenter, kopimedicin og uforudsigelige aktiekurser. Forestillingen Guldgarden kredser om idealisme, videnskab og kapital. Fra ønske om at redde menneskeliv til spørgsmål om penge og hvornår bliver midlet til målet og omvendt. Jeg synes, at det var god præstation af skuespillerne, især Marie-Louise Wille og hendes diktion, som jeg fortalte hende om efter forestillingen. Derudover spillede Henrik Prip, Ernesto Carbone, Sebastian Henry og Ågård Williams. Selve teatret, sal nummer 1, er meget fin, med skrågul, så man bliver ikke generet af foransidene. Desuden blev man budt på velkomstdrink og efter forestillingen på let anretning. Jeg vil gerne anbefale at se denne forestilling. Forestillingen varer 2 timer med 20 minutter pause og spiller til den 21. februar 2026 i Allerød og fra 3. til 12. marts 26 i Gladsaxe.
Tena, 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 ha, banot u'ena, chayalim, bamosha